Matter of Leah Coleman versus Sonia Martinez. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Your Honor, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Mark Lockett, L-O-C-K-E-T-T. I'm appearing on behalf of the petitioner, Sonia Martinez.
Good morning, everyone. Gary Ginsburg of the firm of Ginsburg & O'Connor, appearing on the respondent, Leah Coleman.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Lockett, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, as I introduce myself, my name is Mark Lockett. I've been practicing in the state of New Jersey for over 30 years, and this is my first opportunity to appear before this court, which I consider an honor.
We're happy to have you.
Thank you. At the outset, I believe it's important to note that the attack upon Ms. Coleman, as I've expressed to Mr. Ginsburg, was horrific, and to which I'm very sympathetic. However, it was an attack that was not foreseeable by Ms. Martinez in her role as the therapist, and for which we believe she should not be responsible under New Jersey law. We believe this court got it right in 1998 when it handed down the JS opinion and ruled in cases such as this, the plaintiff must demonstrate that the harm to the plaintiff or risk of harm was one that was particularly foreseeable. That is, a plaintiff may be required to prove that the defendant was in a position to know or have reason to know from past experience that there was a level of likelihood of conduct on the part of the third person that was likely to endanger the safety of another. Members of the court, in order to apply this concept to the facts of this case, we believe it's important to consider the totality of the facts and the circumstances that led to the attack here. A detailed chronology of the facts from the moment Ms. Edwards came under the care and supervision of Ms. Coleman and Ms. Martinez up until the day of the attack is set forth in our materials. I believe there's some certain facts that are important to revisit with the court. In her initial psychiatric evaluation, Ms. Edwards was noted to be calm, cooperative, pleasant, compliant during her stay, and there were no episodes of violence or aggressive behavior. Admittedly, Ms. Edwards had two prior legal problems, which were assaults in 2007 and 2011, which were remote from this incident. When the Hispanic Family Center initially evaluated Ms. Edwards for risk assessment purposes, they determined that she was a low, medium risk to others because the incidents were remote and had occurred more than a year prior to her enrollment. The Hispanic Family Center's multidisciplinary assessment in November of 2013, about a year before this incident, determined that she was low risk for suicidal or homicidal conduct. If we fast forward, to the time period of April through July 2014, there were instances where Ms. Martinez suspected that Ms. Edwards was responding to outside stimuli. On October 1st, 2014, more than a month before this the attack, Ms. Martinez reported to Ms. Coleman that Edwards had been compliant with both taking her medication and attending therapy sessions. Importantly, it was reported, members of the court, that there had been no symptoms of psychosis or an indication that she would harm herself or others. And if you move forward further to October 28th, 2014, it was reported to Ms. Martinez by Ms. Coleman that family members in the Edwards family had reported hearing commanding, that Edwards had reported hearing commanding voices that she felt obligated to act or respond to these commands. On November 3rd, a few weeks within the attack, Ms. Coleman encountered Ms. Edwards at the CPP office in Camden, at which time Ms. Edwards asked Ms. Coleman whether she was sending her telepathic waves, a but there was no indication of any violence or threats of violence. Moving forward again to November 7th, Martinez met with Ms. Edwards, Ms. Martinez did, and told her, and was told that Coleman had told her about auditory hallucinations that have been reported by the Edwards family. She became upset, but there's no indication again of any violence or threats of violence. And lastly, on November 13, 2014, just 4 days before the attack occurred, Edwards made an unscheduled visit to CPP, where she met with Ms. Coleman and Donna Johnson, a supervisor there, and wanted to make sure that they understood that her comment made to Ms. Coleman on November 3rd about sending telepathic waves did not reflect that she was crazy, but that she wanted to ensure they were on the same wavelength and wanted to know what CPP would tell the court about her behavior.
Mr. Locke?
Yes.
Can you tell us what theory of liability has Ms. Martinez pursued throughout this case? Has it been the particular foreseeability of JS? Has it been some theory in addition to that? Tell us your understanding.
The theory that Ms. Coleman, the plaintiff, is pursuing is... Your Honor, thank you. My client breached the standard of care by failing to report the auditory hallucinations to the psychiatrist, who was also taking care of Ms. Edwards, and also was negligent by telling Ms. Coleman that she was the source, telling Ms. Edwards that Ms. Coleman was the source of the information about auditory hallucinations being reported to CPP.
What legal construct has Ms. Coleman relied on in advancing that argument? Is it the theory outlined in JS or some other source?
I believe it's a theory, it's a negligence theory similar to that outlined in JS, Your Honor.
Counsel, your client is a licensed social worker?
Yes.
But not a licensed clinical social worker?
Correct, Your Honor, and that's why the statute would not apply to her under these circumstances.
Okay.
The immunity doesn't apply, but do you think that the statute standard is relevant at all?
Your Honor, I guess that we have to rely upon the legislature to change the definition or expand it. But here, I believe in spirit, it should apply to my client, but specifically under the terms of the language of the statute, it does not. Additionally, members of the court, it's our position that the appellate division's reliance upon Ms. Edwards' history of command auditory hallucinations, her prior but remote history of assaults, and the need for monitoring in the event of decompensation, as well as her desire to gain custody of her 5 children, while notable, we believe they do not rise to the level of particularized foreseeability outlined in JS, and also commented upon by other courts in McIntosh and McKay, which I realize is an unpublished decision, but its reasoning I think is instructive. Where in McIntosh, for example, the assailant had shown outward acts of violence, had shot a BB gun to the victim's window, had expressed outward signs of anger, and there were other indicia. Contrasting that to the McKay decision, Your Honor, Your Honors, that where the attack by a person under psychiatric care was one that the psychiatrist and doctors had no notice and there was no provocation. There, the court ruled, as we believe should be ruled here, and where the error was committed by the appellate division, that there was no particularized foreseeability to impose a duty upon the practitioners.
Counsel, putting aside the issue of foreseeability, do you accept that your client breached a duty of care that she owed to Ms. Coleman by disclosing her name as the source of revealing that T.E. had these auditory hallucinations?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because there, again, with the indicia of the facts during her care, there was no indication that Ms. Edwards would commit acts of violence.
I'm not talking about the foreseeability issue, but Ms. Coleman was employed by DCCP and was making decisions whether or not the tortfeasor, I'll call it the tort, was going to get her five children back. And by disclosing the name of the DCC worker as revealing the auditory hallucinations, that certainly was communicating to her that that someone might be working against that goal of reunification. And that your particular client was disclosing that information unnecessarily. What do you have to say about that?
I think it's a problem that I have in the case, Your Honor, that would have to be dealt with if it goes back to the trial level, the law division level. But I think there are other defenses as relates to proximate cause that will be explored at the trial level.
Counsel, just to follow up on Justice Alvin's question, what is your position on whether your client breached her duty of care in deviating from the professional standard of care, given that the protocol that was set for TE in this case was for your client to immediately refer her to a psychiatrist when there were signs of decompensation with TE? And here, your client observed her seemingly having some hallucinations, was told that she was experiencing hallucinations by her group therapy session, people in her group therapy session, and then was further received the report from Ms. Coleman that family members had indicated that she was beginning to have hallucinations, and further that she was not reporting those hallucinations. But your client did not immediately refer her to see the psychiatrist. Do you think that her inaction in not following that protocol breached a professional standard of care that could support liability here?
I do not, Your Honor, because there are issues of whether the decompensation or the auditory hallucinations were suspected, but they were never confirmed by my client first.
But your client was made aware that TE was specifically not telling her about the auditory hallucinations that she was experiencing, correct?
Yes. But secondly, she had when she was seen on November 7th, there was a session scheduled with her psychiatrist, I believe it was on November 18th. And in exercising her judgment, Ms. Martinez thought that was sufficient because of no emergent issues for her to see her psychiatrist coming up on November 18th.
Is there anything else you'd like to present, Mr. Lockett?
Only, Your Honor, that I guess I can put in put things into summary. As I indicated, the appellant's division's reliance, I believe, in rendering their decision on the history of auditory hallucinations, the prior remote history of assaults, the need for monitoring in the event of decompensation, and her desire to gain custody over her children, while notable, it doesn't arise to the level of particularized foreseeability as analyzed by the judge in the law division in this case, who went through the facts and specifically found that there was no particularized foreseeability. For those reasons, Your Honors, and those set forth in our briefs, we ask that the ruling by the appellate division be reversed and the order of summary judgment dismissing my client from the case be put back into effect. And I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lockett. Mr. Ginsburg, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice. This case raises the question as to what is foreseeability when a tort is committed not by the person alleged to have breached the standard of care, but by someone else, a third person. And in this case, it is the relationship of mental health provider and patient, which gives rise to this question. And I think the issue of duty was argued as to whether or not it existed here only as to the issue of foreseeability. The other factors which a court uses to decide whether a duty exists, such as the comparative interests and relationships of the party, public policy and fairness, those issues were not argued, and I think for good reason, because if those issues were put to close scrutiny here, the answer would be certainly come down in favor of the plaintiff that a duty should exist. So now we get to the issue of foreseeability. As noted in counsel's argument, the statute concerning public mental health professionals does not apply in this case. Yet it appears that counsel in his argument looks for the standard set forth in that statute to apply, because it is that very strict standard that requires that a threat of imminent serious physical violence against a readily identifiable individual be communicated. And the circumstances are such that a reasonable professional in the practitioner's area of expertise would believe the patient intended to carry out that threat. That's not particularized foreseeability. That is much more than particularized foreseeability. That is a statutory threshold which must be met if the statute applies. And we know that statute doesn't apply for the easiest reason is that this licensed social worker is not one of the protected people listed in the statute. So then what do we do with this issue of foreseeability? And again, as I said, the real issue is here is how do we approach these cases from a legal standpoint where the person committing the tort is not the person against whom the plaintiff is saying breached a duty of care. And there appears to be in the unpublished decisions of the appellate division, two different directions in which the cases have gone. And the first I want to address is the issue of particularized foreseeability. And again, in evaluating this issue, the court, since this is a motion for summary judgment, must take all the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And one of the most significant portions of that puzzle is the expert opinion of plaintiff's expert psychiatrist, Dr. Dacus, who says that if you put together all the pieces here, it clearly was reasonably foreseeable that T.E. would commit an act of violence against Leah Coleman if, in fact, her psychosis was not immediately attended to and treated. And that is precisely what happened here. The court has ruled that Dr. Dacus's opinion is not a net opinion, and it certainly is not a net opinion. This patient had previous history of both violent acts and psychosis. She had current events which were indicating that she was in the spell of a psychotic episode. And you have no evidence that contradicts any of this. And she exhibited two of those episodes in front of the defendant, Ms. Martinez, as late as July and August of 2014. And in fact, Ms. T.E. herself had admitted to family members that she was hearing commanding voices and really in the midst of a psychotic episode. And Ms. Martinez was made aware of that, as proven by the demonstrated by the email of Leah Coleman. And she did nothing about it. She did not have the right to say, well, you have an appointment scheduled on the 18th of November. And that, of course, this goes to duty. But she did, or standard of care, I should say, she did not have the right to detour the treatment plan, which required that it was an immediate referral to a psychiatrist if, in fact, TE demonstrated signs of decompensation, which the record is replete with evidence that she did. And then the question is here for the court, is there this standard of particularized foreseeability, one that is met by the facts of the case and the opinion of Dr. Dacus? And when I say met, it is met that it goes forward to a jury for the jury to be the ultimate decider on this issue. While duty is typically reserved for the court, the court's decision in JS opined that there was a duty if the plaintiff, through discovery, could prove certain things. And that's the same thing here, is what the appellate division said, and what I think is the proper application of the law. If the jury are to believe everything, all the evidence that plaintiff has put forth about particularized foreseeability, then there is a duty, and the plaintiff is entitled to recover.
Mr. Ginsburg, can you clarify for us? You argued that a duty exists and that you satisfy the standards set forth in JS, and that the statute belongs to one side in this case. Do you rely on any other legal construct for arguing the existence of a duty?
Yes, I do. The other legal construct that we rely upon is that which is put forth in Vizzoni.
And tell us, before you get into the particulars of us, tell us when these theories were first introduced to the case.
Well, this theory was first introduced to the case. So Vizzoni, as my recollection serves me, was not decided until after all of the briefs were submitted in this case, an oral argument was scheduled before the appellate division. And the appellate division asked us by way of email both to consider the Vizzoni case and be prepared to argue it. We were prepared to argue it, but the court asked no questions about Vizzoni. And I think they did that because they found the facts clearly sufficient to prove what is a higher burden of this concept of particularized foreseeability.
Did you rely on Marshall versus Klebanoff for the restatement?
No, I do not read. I did not. Marshall versus Klebanoff clearly says that I think that the relevant portions of Marshall are that Marshall said that statute giving immunity to mental health providers does not apply when there is a common law allegation of breach of duty. So in Marshall, there was an abandonment theory. In this case, likewise, there is a theory that the TE was not properly treated and assessed for her psychosis. So the standard of care is here, it arises out of a breach of a common law duty, which is very much detailed by a plaintiff's expert.
Mr. Ginsburg, what are we to make of the fact that, assuming that T.E. was going through these psychotic episodes, she never gave voice to a threat of harming someone.
Yes,
and well, particularly not a threat of harming Ms. Coleman.
Yes, that is only a requirement of the statute, and that statute does not apply here. And I urge the court.
So I understand that. I'm thinking in terms of particularized foreseeability. Forget about the statute. Can you meet the standard of particularized foreseeability when, even if there were command hallucinations, we don't know what those command hallucinations were about. Go ahead.
Yes, I think there's a totality of the circumstances here that the court needs to use to apply whether or not there was sufficient proof of particularized foreseeability. And what JS says about particularized foreseeability is very much instructive here. And what they talk about is highly extraordinary consequences. And they say that if proximate cause were to rely on a highly extraordinary consequence, then no foreseeability can be had.
So in JS, the observations of the spouse, it was you said in your argument that the relationships gives rise to particularized foreseeability here, but I believe what you're arguing is that the relationship plus the observations by the defendant were sufficient to give rise to that. Am I correct that that's your argument? It's not just the relationship.
Yes, that is correct, Justice.
Okay. So when you're dealing with him, I'm sorry, just
no, go ahead, please.
Quick follow up, I'll finish up quickly. When we are dealing with a mental health professional who is seeing a patient and the patient's condition may change over time, what is the principle? What is the test that would be a little bit different from JS? That was a layperson. Yeah. What is the test that you would have the court apply to a professional's observations of a patient that would trigger the duty to report to a psychiatrist or take action along those lines?
Well, I think it's the existing duty of care which the practitioner owes to the patient. In this case, plaintiff's expert has opined that there was treatment which deviated from accepted standards of care. And so it's not creating any extra onerous duty of care on the mental health professional. The mental health professional can defend this action simply by saying, well, we did conform with the appropriate standard of care.
So as long as the mental health professional is meeting her standard of care to the patient,
yes,
that's all that is sufficient. And you're arguing in essence that, for example, if the situation was not at the point where involuntary commitment would be appropriate in the professional's judgment, then there would be no duty to recommend involuntary commitment in order to protect a third person. Is that your position?
I think so, Judge. It's a very complicated question because
it is part of what we're dealing with here because I think what I'm hearing from you is if what is right for that patient, if pursuant to the standard of care, is to allow her to go about her daily life and try to get her children back, there is no breach of duty to that third person. Is that your position?
Well, this case, I have a dual position in this particular case because of separate facts. So I think the first question is, did she deviate in accepted standards of care in not providing her patient with care for her psychosis? The second element here is that she went beyond that and said, you know, the CPP worker says that your family has told her that you're hearing commanding voices. So this case is very unusual in the specific facts. She brought Ms. Coleman into the therapy session. And she brought Ms. Coleman into the zone of danger by identifying her as the person who ratted her out. And there's just no other way to say it. She wanted to conceal this information. She told her family members that she wasn't telling her therapist about it. And it wasn't her family members who spilled the beans. It was Ms. Coleman. So I think this there are two principles here, two different elements of this case. The first is the professional standard of care that she had between herself and her patient. And in this very unusual fact-specific case, by dragging, and I know, I think it's Marshall or one of the cases alludes to this fact. If the victim becomes part of the therapy session, then there is no reason to doubt that there is the potential that there is particularized foreseeability here.
Well, Marshall's different facts than we have here. And one of the things that I'm concerned about, counsel, is how broadly foreseeability is being used to expand the duty here. Because as you know, foreseeability can arise either in the articulation of the duty or when you're looking at the breach. So here, we're looking at it in terms of the legal question of duty. And in Justice Handler's JS opinion, when he acknowledged that there are certain circumstances where a party can be responsible for the actions of a third person, as we have here, you have to look for the person, the defendant's reason to know, and this is the part that is catching me up in this case, that a particular plaintiff or identifiable class of plaintiffs would likely suffer a particular type of injury.
Yes.
That's not the statute. The statute says we want imminence. Justice Handler defined it as you really need to know that a particular person or group of persons are going to be at risk. And that's why we're imposing a duty based on foreseeability of that particular harm to that individual or group.
Yes.
He found it in the wife's situation in JS.
Okay.
I'm having trouble in this case as a legal matter getting over the lack of that particular legal concept of harm to a particular individual on these facts, because I don't see it in the expert's report. The expert's report is doing a lot of if this, if they'd gone to the psychiatrist, if she had gotten psychotropic drugs, she wouldn't have engaged in violent behavior and therefore the action wouldn't have happened. That reads like a series of dots to try to connect a breach, but it doesn't establish the kind of connection that foreseeability is requiring under JS in order to impose particularized duty. Can you help me with that?
I hope so. First of all, Dr. Dacus did state in an affidavit that was offered in opposition to the summary judgment that based on Ms. Edwards' history of psychosis and violence, the fact that she was not getting treatment for her psychosis, and the fact that Ms. Coleman had been identified as the person providing information that Ms. Edwards was experiencing command auditory hallucinations, it was reasonably foreseeable that Ms. Edwards would commit a violent act against Ms. Coleman if her psychosis continued to be untreated. And so I think he is offering expert testimony clearly to support that Ms. Coleman was one of the easily identifiable persons who would suffer as a result of this untreated psychosis because of the identification of her as the person who had supplied information of her hearing commanding voices.
I think that what you just read could support an opinion on proximate cause, but I'm having a difficult time interpreting what you just read as an articulation or basis for articulating a legal theory of duty.
Well, you know, Judge, I want to answer a little more about JS in a moment. I hope I won't forget to do that. But the particularized foreseeability and proximate cause are almost identical issues. I mean, we foreseeability is, as a matter of law, a part of proximate cause in every case where foreseeability is challenged. I mean,
well, if that's true, then by stating the duty as you have proven proximate cause.
No, I'm stating the duty.
To meld together those two elements?
But I still think it's an issue of fact for the jury to determine here. This was a motion for summary judgment with all of the facts taken in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And as the court decided in JS, they decided that there could be a duty if certain facts were established. And then they also said those facts are to be decided by the jury.
Well, this is where I see a difference between JS and the statute. In JS, our court required a very narrow and well-articulated basis for fearing harm to a distinct person or identifiable group of persons yes. that would impose a duty on someone else to control a third party's behavior, or at least warn of it.
Yeah.
In the statute, that constraint is found its voice in the imminence requirement.
Sure.
Is different, but it's another choice that the legislature made, you know, that somebody has a duty to warn and therefore might be subject to the immunity that's created if they do certain things.
Right.
We're in this in-between land where I'm not hearing an identifiable risk of harm to our plaintiff coming up in what you're pointing to.
Okay, well, I guess it two things. One, it is my position that because of the totality of the circumstances and what was going on here, T.E. trying to get her kids back, T.E. trying to conceal from her therapist that she was hearing commanding voices because she knew that that would prevent her from getting her kids back. T.E. having a history of psychosis, T.E. having a history of violent acts, and the therapist not only failing to treat T.E., but pouring gasoline on the fire by saying, the person who is providing me information that would prevent you from getting your kids back is Leah Coleman. So it can't be any more particularized than that. Leah Coleman, her name is not in the therapy note, but she is identified as the CPP counselor. So there is clearly evidence here.
Is there anything in the record to indicate that the prior acts of violence committed by TE were related to a psychosis?
Yeah, I believe that the circumstances under which they were committed do, and I think Dr. Dacus has alluded to that in his report, that certainly a reading of what happened, and I don't have the details in front of me, would cause a reasonable therapist to worry that she was in a psychotic state at the time that she committed these acts of violence. And before I forget, I wanted to distinguish JS from this case. There's a very important distinction in JS. In JS, the wife owed no duty to the husband for anything that arose out of the tragedy that occurred in JS. She didn't owe him any duty of care at all. In the case at hand, and so the question was, not owing him any duty, did she owe his victims a duty? In the case at hand, the defendant in this case, Sonia Martinez, already owed the same duty that we are in part claiming she owed to Leah Coleman. So, and that is talked about in Vizzoni. And I know these are sort of hybrid concepts, but we are not, what's important here is in JS, The plaintiff was being, the defendant was being asked to do something more than she had to do in her normal relationship with her husband.
Is it your position also that the family members of TE were also in the zone of danger?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sure, they were in the, they were particularly identified. Sure, they were particularly identified as part of the folks. And this is a rather limited zone of danger. I mean, we're not asking the court to say that whatever Sonia Martinez did or might not have done exposed the general public to a danger. And that is the theory that was rejected in McKay. And in McKay, which defense counsel relies upon, plaintiff's counsel admitted that there was no particularized foreseeability concerning the victim in that case. He was just a member of the general public, and they admitted that there was no particularized foreseeability.
I'd like to follow up on your comment that the duties are coextensive. By that, I mean the duty to the patient and the duty to the third party.
Yes.
Getting away from the facts here, let's talk about a psychiatrist who has the authority to take action to involuntarily commit someone.
Yes.
Could there be a situation where a psychiatrist in his or her judgment does not see the individual as a danger to herself and does not see a clinical need to involuntarily commit someone other than the fact that there's a potential for danger to a third person? And if that psychiatrist takes action to involuntarily commit that person, are they violating a duty? Because they're doing that to protect a third person.
Well, I would respectfully submit that would depend upon the standard of care that is developed in the trial. If the standard of care owed to the patient is not one to commit if they are a danger to others, then perhaps there would be no duty owed to that third person.
So in essence, you're saying, and the reason I raise this is that any principle this court develops is potentially applicable to a lot of different permutations on this situation. So it is your position that the standard of care that applies to the patient is all that is owed to that third person. Do you understand why I'm pressing this distinction? Because it seems that there may very well be situations where the standard of care doesn't address or not address a danger to a third person.
That may be. And then I think the burden on the plaintiff to be successful would be much higher than here. But I must also get back to the specific fact in this case that whether or not a jury were to determine that there was a breach of the standard of care to TE, there's the alternative theory in this case that Ms. Coleman was brought into the therapy session and therefore.
I understand that's almost a separate theory that you have going, but I'm talking about here the failure of the defendant to contact the psychiatrist is what you're saying is a breach of the standard of care to the plaintiff. Well, I'm just wondering why it is that you feel that you so confidently argue that the duty to the third person is circumscribed by the standard of care owed to the patient.
I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying here, one of the arguments that we're making is that all we're saying it's the same duty. It might not be circumscribed, but this is the easier route.
Why is it the same duty? I don't understand that. It seems to me the duty may be more expansive. One of the duties may be contact the psychiatrist. The other duty is to tell the soon to be victim or victims that they are in danger so that they can take steps to protect themselves.
That
duty would go beyond just dealing with the patient.
Yes.
It would deal with the third party soon to be victim.
I don't mean to circumscribe the duty in general. What I mean to be saying here that in this case, where the one of the theories of responsibility is based on a deviation from the standard of care that was owed by the therapist to the patient, is the same breach that resulted in the harm to the plaintiff. That's an easier concept to connect. And I rely on Vizzoni for that. In Vizzoni, there was an allegation that the treating physician did not properly warn the defendant of the potential side effects of the prescription medication that he was prescribing. And the court in Vizzoni said, well, you know, the physician owes that duty to the patient. And just because the patient is in here protesting that he breached the duty, we're not going to foreclose the victim from making that argument. And that's the same argument I'm making here, that logic in Vizzoni, where the same breach is said to have caused both damages to the patient and the third party. And of course, in Vizzoni, the court rejected particularized foreseeability as a necessary element, and though dismissed the case because there was no evidence that the side effects of which the patient was not warned about actually occurred and actually contributed to the happening of the automobile accident. It is clear from Vizzoni that if the side effects had occurred, not only would the victim of the automobile accident had a right of action against the physician, but so would have the patient for the same identical breach. And when
under Vizzoni, there is no particularized foreseeability requirement any longer. Is that how you read Vizzoni?
I read Vizzoni as saying that in order to come up with a So Vizzoni is different from JS, because in Vizzoni, there is that relationship between the defendant, the doctor, and his patient who actually caused the harm. So
Vizzoni. So because of that, the doctor owes a duty to any member of the public with whom the patient interacts who may be harmed by the patient.
The restatement pretty much says that. I guess I'm making a hybrid argument here. I think these facts are sort of the best of both worlds, because the evidence of foreseeability, of particularized foreseeability clearly rises, and all I'm saying is that it clearly rises to the level that it's a jury question. There is a mountain of circumstantial evidence that an expert, and I think an expert needs to analyze the evidence. I don't think as lay people we can. There's a mountain of circumstantial evidence that an expert says should have put this person on notice that it was particularly foreseeable that Leah Coleman would be attacked. And unless this court is willing to throw out that evidence as a matter of law, which I think would be grave error, this issue of particularized foreseeability, if you wish to hold that it exists, go to a jury. And I think that again, J.S. comments on foreseeability, it can't be something that is highly extraordinary. It can't be an event that there is no evidence to show that it was foreseeable, that it was highly extraordinary. And there's and certainly Dr. Dacus's opinion in this case refutes that the notion that this was a highly extraordinary occurrence. He does support his decision with a mountain of facts, and again, even going to the model charge for proximate cause, it says rather a reasonable person should have anticipated the risk that the defendant's conduct could cause some injury, loss, or harm suffered by the plaintiff. If, in other words, if some injury, loss, or harm from the negligence was in the realm of reasonable foreseeability, then the injury, loss, or harm is considered foreseeable. And that's all the question of foreseeability ever is. If you want to latch onto that, the word particularized, meaning Leah Coleman, well, again, there's a mountain of evidence supported by expert testimony that says that the defendant in this case should have realized that there was a particular risk of harm to Leah Coleman.
Other questions, anyone? Mr. Ginsburg, anything you'd like to say in closing?
I guess in closing, Your Honor, it just seems to me that the facts of this case scream out that a jury decide the issues here. Whether the Vazzoni logic is adopted or the doctrine of particularized foreseeability is adopted, this is a jury question. There is nothing that, in this case, that would cause one to conclude that what happened here was highly extraordinary or beyond the realm of foreseeability. There's a mountain of evidence that this woman was psychotic in the past. She was violent in the past. And that she was trying to hide the very information that Leah Coleman was trying to give to her therapist.
Understood. Thank you, counsel. And we'll take the matter under advisement.